Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. This is a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Recording on Thursday, July 29th, 2021. I'm Jeff O'Neill, and I'm here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from the increasingly abstract web entity attribution that is BookRiot.com. Is it the URL? Is it the brand? Is it our cloud of newsletters and affiliated products? We're from Book Riot. We're from Book Riot. Can we say that now?
I think we should drop the .com. Yeah, we're just from Book Riot.
Yeah, that's a good point. Have you checked out the Google.com recently?
Well, it was so interesting. I just finished reading An Ugly Truth, yes. The big book about Facebook, and having to see them refer to it in the copyrighted the Facebook way that it was just in the first couple of years Facebook. When it was thefacebook.com. I was like, I remember that. Whoever thought that was a good idea?
It was Zuckerberg. In the social network, and I don't know if it's true or not, but Timberlake plays Sean Parker, the Napster guy, and his big thing is just to go, just Facebook. Like there's a big thing, so yeah, that's a good note. We're suffering from an embarrassment of riches when it comes to cringe tell-alls about startups, because I got this WeWork book that I'm interested in. The Facebook one I think is a bridge too far. Ben Mezrich has a book coming out about meme stocks and Robinhood. I just saw that in Publishers Weekly the other day, which I'm very interested in. Did you see today that the CEO and co-founder of Nikola, which is one of the myriad electric vehicle startups of various levels of business,
business. That is some subtle shade, and I appreciate it.
I don't think it's that subtle. It's like, is there a thing here or not? It's really hard to know. And then the rise of SPAC, special purpose acquisition companies, I think is what's... There's a whole bunch of malfeasance with various levels of... feloniousness coming
out. Yeah, the Facebook book, I will say, is not a insidery tale of a startup. It's almost exclusively about the now decades-long history inside Facebook of making decisions intended to avoid government regulation. And making decisions without real imagination about how this might play out 10 or 20 years in the future when more people and more cultures are impacting their politics with Facebook. I was just the eyeballs emoji for most of it in a way that made me feel kind of sick to my stomach.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I read it.
Yeah, okay. we've got it's going to be a bit of a survey, year in review, a lot of big things. Book, Amanda Nelson for us. Amanda did this, right? The Pandemic Reading Habits Survey? I didn't want to get that wrong. Where we surveyed Book Riot readers about what their reading habits changed, how they didn't change over the course of the pandemic, which is now going to have a little bit of longer legs than we had hoped, it looks like, in many ways, or in different factions and get vaccinated and all of that stuff. Publishers Weekly had a survey of people writ large and their reading habits. And I've got some Publisher Weekly stuff about sales year to date, which I think is very interesting. But before we do all that, let's get into a first sponsor, and you've got some updates about what is and is not historical fiction, but we'll handle a sponsor first.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi. If you like pretty things, like I like pretty things, I got something for you. The stunning sequel to the worldwide phenomenon Children of Blood and Bone is now available in a deluxe paperback edition with gorgeous spray-painted and stenciled edges and an exclusive excerpt of the earth-shaking Children of Anguish and Anarchy. Now, this is a series for you if you like action, you like world building, you like mythology retellings, lore retellings, specifically of a West African variety, has all that and more. It was also an instant number one New York Times bestseller, a Good Morning America book club pick, and now both Children of Bone and Children of Virtue and Vengeance are available in these deluxe editions. They're pretty, they're gorgeous. The finale to the series is coming June 25th this year, so you can get the pretty editions of the first two books and be ready for the last book. You see what I'm saying? So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi for sponsoring this episode.
So, Rebecca, Mary Jane, you have decided it is not historical fiction. You read it. Are you done?
Yes, okay. I read it over the weekend.
And
it's a good summer novel. Okay. It is not historical
fiction. Tell me why, based upon the 7 to 78 priors and definitions we floated with various degrees of certainty last episode.
So the elevator pitch is that it's about a teenage girl in the suburbs of Baltimore who gets a summer job as a babysitter for another family nearby. And the family, the dad in the family, is a psychiatrist who's treating a famous rock star for addiction. And because he's so famous, the guy is like hiding out in their house, and his partner, who is a movie star, is there as well. And this is like the whole intrigue. Mary Jane is there to take care of the kid because dad is busy treating the rock star and mom is busy entertaining the rock star's wife. And it's the 70s. And they're just not terribly engaged as parents. There are like a few 70s set pieces, like, you know, some references to other popular bands and that kind of thing. But for the bulk of the story, you could set this in any time because it's mostly about this young girl has a particularly like strict family life where she doesn't know that she doesn't feel connected until she goes and spends her summer with this other family. And they are very like, they're messy, but they're effusive and they love each other and they kiss their daughter and tell her that they love her and they welcome her into their family. And she has that epiphany that we all have in some way when we get outside of our own family's households of like, oh, this is what life could be like in some other version. And you could move that story into literally any decade. Like, you could move it forward and the technology of hiding the rock star gets complicated because of smartphones. You could move it back into the 50s and the households would be serving different food and listening to different music. And maybe it's like an Elvis kind of rock star instead of a 70s groovy dude with, you know, like his shirt unbuttoned and wearing feathery necklaces. But it's the story is relatively timeless. The 70s stuff is details. It is not historical fiction.
I think even by our which I find myself now to be persuaded by, that historical fiction covers things that reside outside the living memory of people who could be writing the book at the time of the book's writing is pretty compelling to me. And by that covers Mary Jane. Now, if this book was set in 1934 and it's about, you know, Chet Baker, you know, a jazz musician, or even I guess people are alive in 1934. It's set in 1896 about Gilbert and Sullivan trying to hide the writers of light operas. But almost by definition, it would have to be historical fiction because no one would understand how things work. So you have to explain more of that stuff, right? Which you don't in 1979 or whatever. By that definition,
And Gilbert and Sullivan are real.
Yeah,
they were real people.
If you had sort of to protect the identities of Gilbert and Sullivan, you had a stand-in. Right. Be careful.
Wilbert and Mullivan.
The USS.
They just go.
Penta Nate. Yeah.
They just go around town wearing those glasses with like big fake rubber noses
so
on.
So awesome. But then using that definition, even Almost Famous itself, which is the comp that got me interested, is also, we don't use this for movies. I don't know if, I guess in movies they call it a period piece. Is that synonymous with you essentially with historical fiction?
I don't know. I would consider Almost Famous to be closer to historical fiction because it really is about that moment in time, like those bands and being a groupie in a way that, like, I imagine there are still, I imagine there are still groupies today, but that it looks pretty different. I think Almost Famous is very much about the '70s.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Lester Bangs saying, "I wish you were here for rock and roll." You know, you missed the thing.
Yeah.
Patrick Fugic saying, you know, kind of coming in at the end. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's interesting. Could you have moved that to 1993, right as Kurt Cobain dies, and it being about grunge, right, or something like that? I think you could reasonably do it.
Yeah.
Interesting to think about. Mm-hmm. I said I was going to read Mary Jane. I didn't. I got distracted by a book I really liked that I had my eye on, The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su by Tom Lin. It is a Western.
Oh.
Kind of
okay.
Absolutely historical fiction. It's like so obviously, but I hadn't really thought about how Westerns are historical fiction almost by what you understand. Western is a subset of historical fiction. I guess there's modern Westerns, like No Country for Old Men.
Mm.
Not historical fiction, I wouldn't say. But
writer Percival Everett. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, like yeah, something like that. But a Western that is set in 1890 is absolutely almost, I guess, really maybe the first flowering of historical fiction was the idea of the Western in like Bret Hart novels or Zane Grey or stuff that happened earlier in the centuries. But even that was sort of concurrent. Like, I do think one thing that you're circling around is almost a fetishization of the time period. Fetishization is maybe too strong. But an overt concern with the minutia of the time is part and parcel of it. So you got to scratch a couple of itches. But I'm glad to hear that Mary Jane was enjoyable. I look forward to reading that on my break here.
It's really fun.
In a couple of weeks. I was going to do some sales stuff because I had this idea. I always have these ideas, Rebecca, as you know. And
ideas?
And I was thinking about some additional segments we could do. We're thinking about some extra content for the fall. And one of these ideas I've had, like, it's something I've had an idea about for a long time of, like, even just for fun. I'm not trying to do one of these authoritative lists on The Ringer of, like, the best 100 TV episodes of all time.
But, okay.
But from a perspective of, like, who are the 100 most relevant writers right now, if you're going to make a list like that, and you can spin relevant all you want, the writers you need to know, something like that. So if you're interested in books, okay, and really what you're maybe interested is knowing about what the zeitgeist is about books at a given moment, who are the 100 you need to cover? And I've had this idea in my head for a while, and something struck me when I was reading Publishers Weekly this week about how you could define that. Because it goes back to the books of the year, and it connects with that books of the year conversation we were having about, it's not just sales, it's not just critical approval, it's sort of, you need two of the three things. I was like, that's kind of interesting for this, because I think you get into some weird situations where many of the best-selling books, best-selling authors would not be on my list of the 100 most relevant authors. I was looking at the hardcover front list fiction. Let me just give you the top 10. Daniel Silva, Laura Dave, Debbie Macomber, Miranda Cowley Heller, Danielle Steele, James Patterson and Bill Clinton, Taylor Jenkins Reid's with her debut novel, Malibu Rising, number 7, Clint McElroy, Matt Haig, Benedict Murray, TJ Newman, Grady Hendrix. And I was like, to get to have 10, I need to get down to number 20, I think, because I'm not including Daniel Silva. You don't, he's not relevant, sells books, but not relevant, right? Would you agree with me in that way?
I do agree with that. It's, selling a lot is one of, you have to have sold a lot of books to get into the zeitgeist, but selling a lot of books doesn't get you into the zeitgeist.
I think the zeitgeist for me, weirdly, is easier. If I need zeitgeist and sales, what amount of sales do you need to cross that threshold? That's the one I'm finding myself struggling with, because the one that's interesting to me this week, The Final Girl Support Group by Grady Hendrix, debuted at number 12 on the hardcover front list fiction list. Okay, it sold 10,000 copies. Okay. Grady Hendrix has had a nice run since his debut Horror Store in 2017 of interesting books, does something a little bit different. Maybe the most aptly named publisher of quirk books, because I don't know what genre this is at this point that Grady Hendrix does. He has kind of the Andy Weir, Dan Brown, kind of invented a subgenre of the thing they write in. But this is a breakout book from him, because the thing is too small and my eyes are too... The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires, the last book that people really liked. It did well on the site. We've seen people talk about it. That sold 4,000 copies in its first week. So this is more than doubling that. And that's up from 700 copies from his earlier book and up from 400 copies for Horror Store in week one. So there's a there's a delta there that I think is interesting. But with that level of sales, a few books, does Grady Hendrix make the 100 most relevant author list? I was like, it caught a short circuit in my brain. Like, it's one of those I am lying statements that confuses computers or whatever. I was like, I don't know. Right. I am going backwards and forward and moving around. Is that, am I crazy? Or am I too tied up in knots? Is that an interesting edge case to you? And I was like, is Grady Hendrix the edge case? Is he like number 98 on my mental list of 100 most relevant authors?
I was going to say, if he's on the list of 100 most relevant authors right now, it's near the bottom.
Right.
And I think it's partially because sales, how many sales you have to get to break into the zeitgeist is a moving target.
Yes.
Like, it depends on what else is out at the same time, who you're competing against, and how those other books are selling as well. Like, there's, and I think, of course, publishing wishes, and I think it would be interesting for us to just have some baseline number where we could say, if you sell this many copies of books in your first week or in your first month or your quarter or whatever, you are going to be like in the popular imagination. You'll be in the zeitgeist. People are going to be talking about the work that you've made. Like, I just don't think that exists, because sometimes there's a huge, you can go the other direction where, like, there's a huge first couple of weeks because there was a lot of pre-publication buzz. And then after the book is released, it turns out to like that the substance doesn't quite stand up to the buzz, and that book goes away from the zeitgeist, even though the initial sales looked like, oh, this is going to be a breakout or this is going to be a big deal. So there's just no way to anchor it directly to the sales, I think. It's some sort of weird, like, quadratic type equation, maybe.
Right, with like multiple feedback loops and recursionary processes.
Yeah, how do you weight these things and how do they impact each other? Because, of course, like, once it starts selling and people start talking about it, it's going to sell more and probably be more talked about. Grady Hendrix is, that's a really interesting one. I think if he makes the list of relevant authors, I guess now we're talking about the particular Grady Hendrix question, it would be because there is something relevant about that sort of genre blending, genre mixing that he does that is unique to this, unique and relatively new to this time in popular fiction.
And when we're talking about zeitgeist, we're not talking about capital Z, we're talking about lowercase reading zeitgeist, like the people who care about books and reading, that don't just read mass market paperbacks, that are interested in picking up something that's interesting. They're interested in being interested in books, I guess, more than anything, rather than just looking for something to read, because that's why I can throw out. I mean, here, let's do the 20 authors, right? Because we can, I think this is interesting. Daniel Silva, we throw out. People like those books. Mm-hmm. They sell. They're not interesting in a macro way. Right. They're just not. Laura Dave, the last thing he told me, I think is a thriller, Simon & Schuster.
Mm-hmm.
Name another book by Laura Dave. What is this book about? I think I'm throwing that out. Debbie Macomber, Daniel Silva situation. Miranda Cowley-Heller, The Paper Palace. I think you need more than one book I've heard of. Me, I'm just saying. Like, I think you need more than one, unless that one is huge. We'll get that to in a second. Daniel Still, I'm throwing out. The Bill Clinton and James Patterson one is a little interesting, because it's not just JP. It's Clinton.
Right.
Is that relevant? I think not.
No.
I think not. Taylor Jenkins Reid's, I would say she's a relevant author. I would guess if I did a differential and I wrote down 100, she would be the top 100. That's my guess right now. The Adventure Zone, no, this is something else. Matt Haig, The Midnight Library, this book is selling. He has a couple other books. I think he's on, I at least write his name down and see who goes ahead of him. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
The person,
I don't know if he makes the top 100, but he's in consideration. Yeah.
Marie Benedict, interesting.
The
Personal Librarian, which is the historical fiction, absolutely historical fiction by Belva DeCosta Green. She does a bunch of these going back into history, finding an interesting, I think exclusively female characters at this point. I could be wrong about that, and sort of shining a light and telling a story that people like. This one's interesting because she does it pretty consistently. They sell very well, and it's, I don't think the genre's completely played out, kind of like a techno thriller or like a regular mystery thriller, but it's also not, I don't know, it's an
it's
intricate,
not fresh
it's not super fresh.
Yeah, I feel like she would have been more likely to be on my list of relevant when the, I can't remember which one was the first one right. of hers, but when the first one came out and it was kind of a new thing that was happening in books, was telling these previously untold stories right. about women who were really important to science and history and had not been acknowledged right. before.
And even if, maybe even if the genre itself is a little long in the tooth or at least getting there, you need to be the standard bearer, which I don't think she is, because the standard bearer is down on the list. We'll get to in a minute. Next one is T.J. Newman's Falling, which is a thriller about a flight attendant. It's selling pretty well. It's a debut novel. I don't think there's anything there. Grady Hendrix. Here's a commercial fiction, Elin Hildebrand for Golden Girl.
Mm.
I don't think so. But again, I maybe would put her on the list to see, but I'm not dismissing out of hand. Or am I? Are you dismissing out of hand for that one?
I don't know. She's very popular.
Yeah.
But not in a doing something new that people want to talk about way.
Right. Where I think you might get someone who just is up a level in terms of zeitgeist is Lyanne Moriarty, who does something similar.
Yes.
I don't think I'm including both of them. If I'm including one, I'm including Moriarty, I think, not Elin Hildebrand.
I think that's a good distinction. And something sort of coming together for me that like Debbie McCumber, James Patterson,
right.
Hildebrand, some of these are sort of mainstay authors of like readers that tend to be a generation or so older than mm-hmm. us. And we're already like a generation right. or so older than the folks who are generally driving the zeitgeist right now. Mm-hmm. And so you also have to be appealing at volume to the audience that is driving cultural conversation.
Yes,
and
right.
that largely now means being appealing and relevant to folks who are participating in literary culture on the internet mm-hmm. in some way.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Andy Weir, I'm absolutely putting on my list, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Alex Michaelides is interesting. The Maidens I read, I didn't particularly like. The book had a giant print run. The first one, The Silent Patient. I think this borderline, if this one had sold better and was better, I'd be more interested in this. On the mm-hmm. other hand, don't you just want Donna Tartt? I don't know. Interesting. Kristen Hannah is next. Yeah. She absolutely goes on the list. I don't think that's what I was talking about mm-hmm. with Marie Benedict. Kristen Hannah she sells the most. People know her. She mm-hmm. close to a brand name. John Grisham. At some point, Kristen Hannah will be John Grisham.
Yes.
But John Grisham is not on the mm-hmm. list.
No.
B.A. Paris, the therapist, not on the list. V.E. Schwab is absolutely on this list.
Mm-hmm.
Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, the darker shade of magic stuff. She's had a whole bunch of stuff. She's extremely online. Genre, crossover genre hits. You got to put on the list. And then the last one is Such a Quiet Place by Megan Miranda. Again, this is one of those commercial thrillers that could be picked by Reese. Maybe this one even was. And they tend to die on the vine 6 months later. And we'll see if anyone cares about her next book when it's not picked by Reese. Right? That's Megan Miranda at this mm-hmm. point. Kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. The nonfiction list, I think all of the one-off political books don't count. Michael Wolff's new Trump book?
Agreed.
Nope. Sorry. On the other hand, Michael Pollan, I think, is on my list. Or at least it's a candidate.
Yeah. I think he's a candidate. He stays relevant, and the subject matter that he writes about gets up. Like, he's updating what he's concerned about mm-hmm. as culture changes what it is concerned about. So
let's use it.
Going from food to, like, plant-based. Yeah. Plant-based medicine and psychedelics is a really interesting evolution.
Here's two that will pain us to think about.
oh, no.
Well, Adam Grant and Gladwell. They're in the same bucket at this point.
I think Adam Grant is relevant.
Okay.
He's still all over, not pop culture, but like you can't swing a cat without hitting a podcast that's interviewing.
Do you think
Adam
he
Grant.
Wakes up with one of those in-ear mics? Because he wears one because he's ready to TED Talk at any time. He's extremely available. Let's put it that way.
Those Madonna mics.
Yes.
Yeah. He just Adam Grant's like cooking breakfast for his kids in the morning, and he's like, you know, it's really important to be mindful, not just about how long you cook the egg, but how you flip the egg.
Gladwell, I think I agree with you that at some point Adam Grant will calcify into a known quantity. No, this happens, right? This is this is why we're excited about people who are exciting, like our boy Colson Whitehead, because you're surprised. Are you going to be surprised by Grant in 2 years with another book?
That's exactly why I think Malcolm Gladwell is either off the list or is making his way off the list, is that he is a pretty known quantity. Yeah. Calcified. There's not a fresh surprise coming. We haven't had a fresh surprise from Malcolm Gladwell in a while. And like, that's fine. He does interesting work and he certainly has an audience for it. But he's not like driving. People aren't talking about Malcolm Gladwell, like, I don't know, at these imaginary dinner parties that no one ever has anyway.
No, that's never existed, where they drink martinis and talk about Proust, right? And also Norman Mailer, like, and also Joan Didion.
Yeah. Right, but like the Tipping Point was a big thing that everybody talked about around the same time that like Freakonomics came out and people were talking about that. And those were sort of the groundbreaking ideas of the time. And I think Adam Grant is closer to the tip of that. Right now, he's talking about technology, he's talking about work, his social media is largely about the intersections of those things, and also just in bigger ways how we understand work inside the culture. Yeah, Grant is in, Gladwell's out.
Gladwell, I might make a case, A, because I like the last book, and B, because what Gladwell's doing in terms of having his own audio production company and being audio first and the richness of the audio production, I think is interesting. So that's a little bit different than the formal medium stuff is pretty, and Bomber Mafia actually was a bit of a departure. Anyway, I think it's more of an interesting question than needing to come up with an answer. And I think it's also important, you just said, it's also important that this is, by saying relevant, you by definition, you're saying this is fluid. You're not saying the most well-known authors. You're not saying the most even important authors, because you could write one really important book and not write anything for 50 years and not be relevant, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I guess right now, again, we try not to talk about her because of her transphobia. But Rowling is an interesting case because I think she's an important Titan, but Rowling's not relevant right now. She just isn't.
Agree.
So that's a good example. And I think Grisham is like that. He's going to go down as one of the best-selling authors of all time. But he's less relevant than King. King mixes it up. He'll try historical fiction. He does other stuff. He'll do a crime novel that's only... King is weirdly very relevant for someone who's published, I think, 10,000 books at this point.
Yeah, and he experiments like in literary culture as well. Like, I'm going to try doing this book that only comes out from independent bookstores. I'm going to try doing this thing that you can't buy on Amazon, or this one is only in print, or this one's only in ebook. And that keeps him maybe not fresh in like the general reading public's mind. But if you pay attention to books, there's, you know, we don't go very long without some sort of Stephen King related headline. Yeah.
And can they surprise you? I think is part of it here. Other ones that are interesting, Isabel Wilkerson, absolutely. Crying in H. Martin Mazzell's Honor. This goes against Jeff's Directive 1, which is you need more than one book, but this is borderline because this is the hipster pick, and I'll throw us into this. People are talking about this, people who care about caring about books and publicly performing their care about books are into this book. Yeah. I might have to long list Zellner right now. I might have to keep her on the list.
Yeah, I can get behind that.
Kind of fun. I don't know. Maybe we'll do 100 at some point and say what goes in. That would be spicy. But it's just for, this is all
for
fun.
Spicy. Fun spicy.
One name I just looked at, Matthew McConaughey's Greenlights, which we talked about how well it sold. We got a nice email from someone at an Austin bookstore. And as you might imagine, they can't keep it in stock. Just selling thousands of copies a week. And this person said, we might alone be keeping it on the bestseller list. And when you look at it, look, it sells 6,000 copies a week. If book people in Austin selling 1,500, that's 25% of the copies. If they weren't selling it, I guess it would, let's say that no copies flowed through book people and it dropped it down to 4,000 copies a week, it would still be on the top 20, I guess.
Yes.
But,
I'm glad for that. Good for Matthew McConaughey.
I'm sorry. While I'm doing the bizarreness, the surprise of what... Number 20 on the hardcover front list nonfiction list this week, the unofficial Disney Parks cookbook. So
there is like no cookbook I've ever wanted less.
So you can make the stuff you can buy at Disneyland, but unofficially. It's not that someone's gone and reverse engineered all the... I know there's enough of a Disneyland fandom out there to support stuff like this. I'm just surprised it made the top 20 of the hardcover fiction.
That's...
Nonfiction, pardon.
Truly, how many units did it sell?
3,500.
Okay.
Just 100 copies behind your Ugly Truth there, actually, turns out.
That's all you need is a passionate Facebook group of Disney people and to launch a situation
like that. Very, very interested in that.
I want to know, like, everything about the lives of the people who are stoked about reverse engineering Disney recipes.
There was a long article in Vulture about adult fans of Disney that...
I read that.
I'm so glad they're happy. I'm so happy for them. Sounds like they're having a great time.
No, please direct your emails to Jeff.
I'm thrilled for them. They sound like they're having a great time. And with that, let's do a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult slash crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
Okay. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the BR one or the Publisher's Weekly one? You want to go micro to macro or macro to micro?
Let's go macro.
All right.
Micro.
So then you have to lead then. You said where we're going to go, so you got to drive.
All right. So macro, Publisher's Weekly. Reading time rose 21% in the second half of 2020. This is according to a survey that was released by the U.S. Department of Labor. It's called the American Time Use Survey, which, like, that's a whole fascinating thing.
How much time did they spend taking surveys? Did they ask that one?
It's very meta, Jeff. Thank you. Reading among people who were 15 years old and over increased by 21% from May to December over the same period in 2019. And the data shows that reading of all kinds increased from 28 minutes per day in 2019 to 34 minutes per day in 2020. So I think there's a few interesting things here. The reading of all kinds is very important, and they don't go into any more detail than that. So we're talking about... I think if you can read it, it counts. So I assume we're talking about books, the internet, newspapers, magazines, whatever. The other thing, I mean, we always kind of throw cold water on a headline like this. It's like, yay, reading time rose 21%. And it's like, all right, we're talking about a difference of six minutes. Like, are the kids really all right? Like, we were reading 28 minutes per day on average in 2019, and then we read 34 minutes per day on average in 2020. And I want to, like, abstract this from the nature of 2020, because if it was like all we did was read for 34 minutes per day in 2020 was a disaster, and getting reading done was really difficult. So doing, if you manage to do anything for 34 minutes a day in 2020, my hat is off to you. Like, probably the only thing I did for 34 minutes consistently in 2020 was like stare off into space thinking about the existential dread.
Yeah.
But in the big picture of like, this is a headline about the health of reading, I guess it's good that it went up. It's not terribly surprising that it went up because we were all locked in our houses and people were buying more books because they weren't going places where they were spending money and doing other things with their time. But the big picture of like reading is up is for me very mitigated by like we're talking about a difference of 6 minutes per day. And this big high number is still 34 minutes when we spend an average of about 3.5 hours a day looking at our phones. Mm-hmm. So
I think there's some breakout stuff there. I guess if we knew this was coming, we should have played the game of what do you think the number is going to be, right? Mm-hmm. I know I remember on whole that 28 per minutes per day is about a half hour is what I have in my brain. Now, again, the delta on that is pretty, the bell curve on that is pretty weird. You've got a lot of people that read a lot more and there's a lot of zeros too at the same time. So if you had said it's pandemic year, what do you think happened to reading time? A, up or down, and then depending on which way you go, what percentage? I would have gone up, for sure, because we know about book sales, and I assume it's at least correlated, so I did that. I don't know what percent number I would have. I can't separate myself from having seen the number now, because part of me is like, only 21%, you had nothing else to do? On the other hand, everyone had the internet and streaming, and it was hard. I read probably less than an average year, and this is borne out a little bit in the demo breakdown. My age group of, let's see, where is it? I was in one of the age group that didn't do as much more, right? The people that read more, weird, more than that 21%, 20 to 34-year-olds, which makes a ton of sense to me. Those are the people that go out the most. They're not going out. They're looking at replacement activities. Makes sense. And people over age 65 read more. Older people were scared crapless, and rightly so. So they really weren't going out. And then people older than 75, by far the most time, A, they read the most anyway in any given year.
Yes.
But 95 minutes a day, they didn't have anything else to do. They weren't streaming Ted Lasso, right? Or most of them weren't. You know, they're not doing TikTok. They went to books a lot for
sweet retirement life.
Yeah.
95 minutes a day of reading. That sounds great.
I'm not surprised that 34 to 65 year olds didn't have the big increase. In my demo, well, yours too, there's a lot of parents there. Mm-hmm. Our time got sucked up.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then our attention got sucked up in different ways. I'm not surprised to see that at all. Black people, 140% jump.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what to do with that. That is surprising. Do we have a theory?
Well, they also say later that economic and educational divides presented a stark picture there, but I don't see like a regression analysis combines these things. And if you, I think it, like by common wisdom, if we take that in general, Black Americans suffer from more disadvantage economically and are at a greater, a greater disadvantage economically for all of the systemic reasons than they were. Well, everybody was sort of stuck in their
houses.
I wonder if
increases was negatively correlated with whether or not you kept your job, because Black unemployment was Black unemployment still lags. Well, so maybe there was more time at home because they were the most likely to lose their jobs on the whole. I don't have a good one.
COVID is also not the only thing that happened in 2020.
Fair.
We had massive protests. And
spurred people to pick up some books maybe. Yeah.
I think that might be part of it, especially since we're talking about reading of any kind, reading about what was going on in the world, reading about the murder of George Floyd and the protests and Black Lives Matter might have been something that was factoring into that as well.
Right. Americans with no high school diploma, the daily average fell 42% to 11 minutes per day. People at least a bachelor's degree increased their reading time by 24%. To 52 minutes per day. Upper middle class folks jumped 131%. Work from home, you're not commuting, I guess, kind of stuff.
Or yeah, folks on the lower end of the educational spectrum probably more likely to have some of those jobs that we considered essential, right, like, you know, grocery and retail, mm-hmm, where they were working more and were highly in demand, yeah, and very stressed out for good reason.
I would love to know if you all have seen out there any studies about Black folks' reading habits over the last year, because it stands out in a way that I don't have a really interesting theory to. Up to 24 minutes a day. So still below the average across all, but up a ton. And I wonder, a further breakdown of that would be fascinating to hear, or if there's some phenomenons going on that we here are not privy to, clearly at this point, to be that surprised.
And that's creates some interesting tension with some of the other stats that we've seen, that Black women as a group spend a lot of money relative to the average on books and a lot of time relative to the average reading. Mm-hmm.
So
lots of confounding.
A fascinating. Yeah. White Americans increased only 19%. So a lot of this pull up 21% that was above, like, that 18 or 19% Asian Americans increased by 9%. Latino Americans stayed flat. Almost all of the pull up by demo came from Black people reading more. It looks like, mm-hmm, based on this, that would be worth investigating and finding out, you know, where that's coming from and how that happened and how it can be built upon. All right. Our own reading survey. Book Riot's
own reading survey. Yes.
Let's start here with us. Did you fill this out?
I didn't fill it out.
Let's do this. Did you read more or less last year? You don't have to look. Just what does your heart say?
I know I read more last year. I know. Okay. Because I keep a spreadsheet.
Yes. Okay. And was it within, was it noise? Was it, you'd say if you picked it out, you could say pandemic year, or like how big of a deal was it?
It was not, well, it was more than 2019 and 2018. Mm. It was not directly because of the pandemic, but I guess tangentially because, well, maybe it was directly because there were some like things that I was doing volunteer wise and outside of my working life that I stopped doing because I didn't want any more stress during the pandemic. So it wasn't that the pandemic forced me to not do those things, but I made some personal choices about how I was going to spend my time and removed myself from some of those extracurriculars and had more time to just like sit down and read. Yeah. So my reading went up, and it is staying on that path for this year, even though I'm like back out in the world more. So that's interesting.
All right.
What about you? You said
a lot less. And most of the difference is audiobooks, which I just wasn't listening to last year because I didn't have the same, those moments of walking the kids and doing the dishes and having time on my own where I could listen and do something else at the same time. I knew it was a lot of my audio time and makes up a significant part of my reading time. I didn't realize how far it would go away. I also had some trouble figuring out what I wanted to read. And
that was very
getting one of those cul-de-sacs of like, you don't know what you want to read, so you stop reading, get out. It's like I find reading to be like exercising. If I've exercised 3 days in a row, my fourth day is way more likely than if I didn't exercise yesterday. Reading is the same for me. And I exercise so little that I have more experience with this book phenomenon. We're gonna let the readers do this, which I just had in this idea. We'll see how it goes. I want you all out there in your head to guess, because I'm gonna give you the stats here in just a minute. But the question one, has the amount you're reading changed? And the answers Amanda provided were more, less, or same. Listeners out there, give yourself 5 seconds to think, what percent of people, respondents to this survey, which remember is a survey on bookriot.com, the actual URL for book readers, what percentage do you think in your mind said they were reading more since the pandemic? Jeopardy music, trademark, you know, whatever. So your boy LeVar at a...
I did.
I didn't watch it. How'd he do?
He did great.
Yeah, I heard he did great. Okay. You've had your chance. The number is 58.4% said they read more during the pandemic. That would jive with the prior we just gave you about what publishers said everyone.
Yep.
But even people who already read quite a bit, the average Book Riot reader says they read 80 books a year or something like that, which is a wild number,
yeah,
completely
like
out of scale.
Something. Yeah.
All right. Rebecca, are you up, down, sideways of your expectation? What number of you would have guessed from there?
I think think this is about right. More than half. I would have expected more than half of people to say they were reading more, just based on what I heard over the last year or so. But I didn't think it was everybody is reading a lot more. And there certainly were people being like, how can you focus on reading?
Yeah.
So, right. Yeah, that's about, I think this is about right.
I would have been surprised by anything above like 80, but I wouldn't have been shocked by like a 75, you know, that our demo, our listeners and readers doubled down, right? Reading something they did anyway, but a lot of people had a lot more time to do it. Not everyone, of course. But just because you had more time doesn't mean you did it clearly. But yeah, on the whole. So if you're awesome at math, that means you know that 41.6% of the field is still available to split between people said they're reading less and say they're reading about the same. So I'll give you another minute to puzzle that out in your head there, see what you think. And the split there is about split, I would say. 18% said they're reading less. 23% said that hadn't changed. So marginally more said that hadn't changed. Statistical significance, blah, 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 data sample. But about, I'd say, is that fairly evenly split? Would you say like kind of equal? Or is that 5% difference big enough for you to matter change?
I think if we were like in a statistics class, I would quibble with it. But we're on a books podcast, so it's fine.
Where we can just say whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Let's see. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go through all of these. Where do you want to? Do you want to do the same game with anything else?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The next question: has the length of books you're reading changed? Yeah.
All right. So yes or no: longer, shorter, or same? LeVar Burton, quibble, quibble, talk, talk, small, small. 70% of people said they read the same book length that usual. I wouldn't even have thought to ask this question, frankly, myself.
I wouldn't either Yeah.
15% said they're reading longer. 15% said they're reading shorter. This means nothing changed. Because like as many people reading longer or shorter, which is just nothing.
A net neutral.
Net neutral. Where you're getting your books from?
Interesting, the big winners there. I don't think we need to go all the way into the percentages, but the big winners were Amazon and independent bookstores. Yeah. That the biggest increase is 31% of people said they were buying more of their books from independent bookstores than before the pandemic. But then another 27% said that they were buying more of their books from Amazon than from before the pandemic. And especially if we factored in book buying habits at the beginning of the pandemic, when Amazon was open, but a lot of independent bookstores were closed or hadn't gotten their online retail situations up and running, that makes sense. Amazon was one of the like persistently available sources there for a while.
Yeah. Most of these things are below, all of them are below 33%. So I'm guessing this actually means probably you have to look at your base rates, right? So Amazon, 27% of people said they're buying more from Amazon. Is what we know is that Amazon represents about 60% of trade sales. So even even more than that is pretty impressive.
That's interesting.
The base rate for indies is pretty low. 6%, I think, of trade in mid-list and other stuff. It's somewhere more influential. So that's 31% of a pretty low rate already. So I'd have to spend a little more time thinking of it. Used bookstores looks like a loser. 18% saying buying more from used bookstores. Those are closed. Hard to get to. With browse stuff, that's tough.
And people were freaked out about touching stuff that other people had touched and owned. And I think the next, there's a question about, did your reading format change?
Yeah, I like that one.
And this is, interesting and about, I think, where I would have expected it to be. 47% of people said that there were changes in their reading formats. And this is that 22% are listening to more audiobooks, 29% are reading more ebooks, and only 11% were reading more physical books. Also, 11% were reading fewer physical books. So physical books just like sort of chilled where they were. But big increases for audiobooks and ebooks, which also makes sense. Deliverability of those was much easier than deliverability of physical objects, especially early on.
Library usage, the stats there are mixed. I don't think it means much. I think Amanda started this wondering about genre. Like maybe is the thing she got interested in the most. There's a pie chart here. It's very satisfying for those of us like this kind of thing. stuck out to me. I think the biggest piece of the pie chart, so it has the most responses, 18.4% percent of people said they were reading with more variety. I thought that's not what I was expecting. A lot of what we heard is reading, running home to mama, reading known things, maybe reading a variety of things you already knew, a buffet of favorite dishes rather than just chicken fried steak, which is clearly the best of all buffet dishes. Just putting that out there right now. More romance, 17.5%, the big individual category winner. I'm not sure what else to say. We'll link to the show notes as well. People might have their own interests here. I don't have another great one that's the most interesting or anything else on the genre breakdown, Rebecca. Anything for you?
Mm-mm. No.
All right.
Looks pretty. There's a lot of variety there. That is an intensely satisfying pie chart.
It's very. I could just look at it. I'm just going to print one out and keep it for moments of distress.
Yeah, just gaze at this pie chart, take a few deep breaths. Imagine that Adam Grant is guiding you through the moment.
So taken all together, more reading, book sales are up. They continue to be very up. I'll just sort of put a button on this with the Publishers Weekly. Trade sales, publishing sales year to date, up 16.8% on a very good year in 2020 for book sales. Unsurprisingly, independent bookstores, the comps year over year are very good because this time last year, there was a little more movement than April and May and June, but still pretty tough. Mm-hmm. The big winner so far this year, young adult fiction, up 47.3% year over year. Is that TikTok?
Mm-hmm. I think it would have to be those titles that TikTok is driving. Yeah.
The biggest loser so far, juvenile nonfiction, and that's only because everyone was buying books for people to try to fake school for their kids last year.
Right.
Adult fiction up 29%. People turn into fiction. Adult nonfiction up 13.6%. So strength on strength from there. All right, let's do one last sponsor. We'll come back and do a couple more stories.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? 6 award-winning, best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all 6 short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laurith Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Housel Hall, Avi Pachoda, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all 6 short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/akillingonthehill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Okay. I don't want to do bad news this week. We'll save it for next week.
Okay.
Booker long list.
I'm fine with that. Sure.
I have, I'm not going to read them all. Things we've talked about before on the list. Great Circle, Maggie Shipstead.
Mm-hmm.
Which I want to read. It's so damn long.
Oh,
look, it's 600 pages, Rebecca. Could she just written the circle at like 400 pages?
Even just a good circle.
Yeah, just an above average circle. 361 degrees.
The good enough circle.
completely sufficient circle. Here's a book that no one was talking about, but now they are. Patricia Lockwood's No One Is Talking About This. Making a Storman off the top rope. Patricia Lockwood, we keep her on the long list for relevant authors, right?
I think so. I mean, Priest Daddy is going to stay relevant for a long time.
Yeah, singular.
As far as I'm concerned.
Claire and the Sun. That's why we're talking about this. Ishiguro.
Yes.
Relevant. Surprising. Nathan Harris's The Sweetness of Water came out last week. It's about a couple of Civil War soldiers that fall in love, romance, interracial. I'm reading this book. I'm not reading it now, but I'm going to read this book. Sounds really interesting. Richard Powers' book, which isn't out in the U.S. yet, Bewilderment, which is like elevated dad book, I should say, Richard Powers at this point. Have you done any Richard Powers work? You know what I'm talking about?
I read the Overstory earlier this year, and I think elevated dad book is where I would put
No shade.
It.
I think that's a great... I'm reading every Richard Powers book at this point for me.
Yeah, it was... I think I got in, like, for my particular wheelhouse... The Overstory got a little oversold of like, it's amazing and it's about nature and trees. And it was like, I kind of ended it up being like, I think you might have underestimated how much I already read about trees.
You take a picture of a tree every day, Rebecca.
Right. Yeah. Right. But I thought it's a very good novel. He puts together a very good novel. There's a lot of craft there. Absolutely. No shade as an elevated dad book.
And I think has to go on our long list of relevant authors. Different enough, interesting enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sciencey, literary fiction. Don't quite know what you're going to get, but you also kind of do. That's an interesting. You don't kind of know what you're going to get, but you kind of do. That's a truth that I have to wrestle with a little bit about some authors.
Right. It's not as reliably, like Colson Whitehead, you reliably kind of don't know what the genre is going to be because he can do anything, but you know how you're going to feel.
Yeah, it's not a random effect generator, right? It's not just like randomly picking something up.
Right.
I don't know a lot of the rest of the books. Rachel Cusk's new book is on here. Some I don't know, which is great. I haven't looked them up before. Anything else you wanted to shout out here?
No, really. Clara and the Sun is also the reason that I'm.
That's why I put it on there, just to say, look how right we were about how great it is.
We and the Nobel.
I was going to say we really bird dogged that Nobel Prize winner, didn't we? Should be Town Scouts. Have you guys considered acquiring books by Nobel Prize winners?
Well, there's a new Louise Glick collection later this year, so. Stay tuned for my live reading and a continued reenactment of how I imagine her therapy
Speaking
goes.
Of, is it harder to make the most relevant 100 most relevant authors list or to make our fall draft when we only get to pick 10? It might be harder to make the 10. It is.
There's the
Cusk, the Richard Powers just on the American side. It is tough. It is a tough field.
Yeah, I have a little document of like titles that are in consideration for our fall books draft, and it has like 35 titles on it.
Unbelievable.
And so even if I pick 10 and you pick 10 more that are on my list too, there will be another 15 we didn't talk about.
It's really wild. It's like, some of those like elite national soccer teams are like the non-starters could probably medal in this competition. It's one of those kind of years.
The fall is just wild.
Movies are this way too.
I would love
to. There's like 17 things I want to see on October 8th alone.
And I would love to hear somebody in like high up in publishing talk about whether there's value to keeping that seasonality, or would it be better to spread out these great titles across the year? Because we can kind of predict, like August is usually pretty quiet for new releases, and then the first Tuesday after Labor Day in September is a bonkers explosion, and the Tuesdays up through like late October tend to be all pretty big, lots of big books. But are you doing a disservice to your authors and your readers by clustering everything like that, and then they all have to compete for the same airspace in that like 7 or 8 week period? And now that media is how it is, could you space them out? I have questions too.
I think for this year, there is a real hope that, again, the kind of books that are on our list are bookstore forward, not just independent bookstore forward, but bookstore patron forward kinds of books. You want to see them on the shelf, you're going to find out, you're going to browse. And people were hoping and thinking, and in June it looked pretty good for September and October being pretty much back to normal for a lot of folks, but because of Delta and, you know, just not people not as vaccinated as quickly as we'd really like them to be, I think it's not going to be as, I don't know, it's not going to be as vibrant in person. And so maybe having a whole bunch of choices on the front table when you walk into Three Lives in Greenwich Village, not as many people are going to do that as maybe we hope they would. So I'm thinking maybe it backfired a little bit. If they had to do over now, make it available a little bit more into mid-July, into mid-August, where people could buy it online or find another places. There's some interesting books coming out in August. You know, Night Bitch came out this week, which I'm going to read, getting nice notices. I really mishandled my tone of talking about Night Bitch on Deals,
Deals,
because I was like, look at this book, what an oddity. And now it's like a hipster thing, and then people are talking about it, and we're taking it seriously. And I'm looking forward to it. I don't know. It's hard to know in those, like, how serious these things are going to be. I should have known it was FSG.
It's hard to know what's a gimmick.
It sounds like it's a gimmick plus. It's a conceit. A conceit is a gimmick for people with MFAs, basically.
Yeah, I recently read Brood, which I think was on either that same Deals episode, or maybe if we've done more than one, it maybe was a previous one, but it's like a woman who's raising a group of chicks and like thinking about her chicks on the small farm that she lives in Vermont and how it relates to being a mother. Mm. And I think that one, it was not gimmicky, but it definitely felt MFA conceit-y. Right. Yeah.
So that's our show this week. We're running a little bit, not too long. Yeah, well, you know, there was one little succeed. Let's do a maybe after succeed. Do you want to take this one to get us out? Well, I don't want to lose this one, but it's not something might come back
to. Yeah, it was, hang on, I'm lost in my tabs.
Yeah, I know.
May your efforts succeed. There was a piece on Book Riot this week by Stacey Megaly about little free diverse libraries. And these are what they sound like. They are little free libraries that focus specifically on BIPOC authors and BIPOC story collections, or collections of BIPOC stories. And it's cool to see this popping up. So she's featuring some of them here. She's writing about how you can help if you want to have a little free diverse library, if you want to support one that's in your neighborhood, and lots of ways to get involved, but really glad to see that. And a really great piece by Stacey. So may all of the efforts around getting more books by BIPOC people into more hands in whatever fashion succeed.
Definitely. You can find a link to that stories and all the links we talked about on this episode at bookriot.com/listen. Email us podcast@bookriot.com. If you have a theory, if you know more about the reading habits of Black folks in general or this year, or if you've seen another piece we could link to, I'm going to do a little research and find out if I can see if there's other insights that people have been talking about in that regard. I'd certainly like to know that. But as always, I'm really digging the reports from people's bookstores. We got a lot of those recently. I think there was the Book Talk one and What I Do With My Historical Fiction, and now the McConaughey. If you work in a bookstore and would be willing, and as you know, I won't use your name without affirmative consent. Sometimes even I won't use it if you do because I forget. But I would love to know what book at your bookstore you think people would be surprised to hear sells a whole bunch or out of scale. I always like these, and it varies. This can be this is where regionalism can come into place, like McConaughey at Green Lights. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Really would like to know. Rebecca, thank you so much as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, have a good one.